Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Steve Schweitzer, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing Rocky Mountain National Park. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Steve Schweitzer about fly fishing Rocky Mountain National Park. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to the new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts to continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers. The Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Steve, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Steve's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Steve Schweitzer's book, which just came out recently, A Fly Fishing Guide to Rocky Mountain National Park. Now, this is a great book, and if you're going to fish the park, it's a must-have as far as I'm concerned. And here's how you can win it tonight. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be about something that Steve and I talk about during the show. And you must submit your answer, along with your name and location, using that text box on the homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills and try to be the first one to get that correct answer. And you'll win Steve's book, A Fly Fishing Guide to Rocky Mountain National Park. So good luck with that. Tonight, our guest is Steve Schweitzer. Steve has been part of the fly fishing retail and conservation industry for over 20 years, including a key position as the VP of Sales and Marketing at Whiting Farms, where he created popular products Bird Fur, Fly Tires Variety Pack, and the Whiting Hackle Gauge. He has also served as president of the Lee Wolf Chapter and treasurer of the Illinois Council of Trout Unlimited. Other behind-the-scenes involvement in the industry includes product marketing consulting and leading fly rod and fly tying tool manufacturers, and an off-and-on fly shop rat since the early 90s. Steve is the co-founder of popular international fly fishing website, globalflyfisher.com, which is in its 16th year. Among his 50-plus articles online, his leader tying article, Hyper Complete Guide to Tying Leaders, and accompanying leader calc software has surpassed 250,000 downloads since original publication in 1999. Over the years, Steve has authored numerous articles appearing in Fly Fisherman Magazine, Angling Trade, Trout, Wall Street Journal, and a myriad of other regional angling publications. He also is contributing author and illustrator for the book Drag Free Drift, Presentation Techniques for Fly Fishing, authored by Joe Gassane, and his fly tying patterns appear in books by Chris Mann, John Shui, FFF Masters, Rick Takahashi, and others. Steve's newest book is entitled A Fly Fishing Guide to Rocky Mountain National Park and was just released January 31st, 2011. Steve makes his home just outside Rocky Mountain National Park in Berthoud, Colorado, with his wife, Carrie, who is a chief flight nurse for North Colorado Med VAC and a contributor for the book as well. And by day, Steve works as a consultant in broadband and digital media industries. Well, Steve, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks a lot. That's quite an introduction. Thanks for reminding me.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Who I am.
Yeah. They get the older you get, Steve, the longer they get. You know.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, we're interviewing one of our previous guests, and there was so much he said I had forgotten. Yeah, most of what I had done in my life. You know.
That applies here for sure.
Yeah, it's a good reminder. Well, good. Well, we're going to talk about Rocky Mountain National Park, one of the great national parks in our country, and. Lucky you and I, we live right by it, so it's we're kind of partial to that place ourselves. I know you are.
Yeah, you bet.
So let's talk a bit about, we do have an international audience, so let's talk about first, where is it located, and then maybe you could just kind of jump into a little history about the park.
Sure. The park is located in north central Colorado, about an hour and 45 minutes, maybe 2 hours north of Denver. As those international guests come into the airport, take you a couple hours to get up to the park. And it's up really close to and just west of Fort Collins, so it gives you a sense of proximity in the state. It's an interesting park in that it's only 1/12 the size of Yellowstone, but receives the same amount of visitorship each year, such as about 3 to 3.2 million people. So you're taking the same amount of people and putting it in Yellowstone as you are in Rocky Mountain National Park.
Okay. And then, talking a bit about the history of the park?
Sure. It's not even 100 years old yet. The national park concept is truly a unique American idea. With most of the parks that we know today, there's over 386 national parks in the U.S., most of them coming within the past 50 years. But this one was started in January of 1915. Woodrow Wilson was the president, and he put it into law by the signature of his pen. But really it was pushed onto his desk by Enos Mills, who we call the father of the park today. But Enos Mills was actually encouraged by John Muir, and everybody knows who John Muir is from the California side of things and the Sierra Club and et cetera, et cetera. But one thing you don't know is Teddy Roosevelt had a big hand in preserving this area. He used to come out and hunt the park area before it was a park, and then he realized later in life that this is a pretty special place. We need to preserve it. Interestingly, John Muir wrote about a month before the park became into existence, wrote Enos Mills that he really wishes success over the next couple months, and we hope to see this come to fruition. It's been a long journey. And then John Muir died a month before he got to see it come to fruition. So just as much a John Muir park as is Enos Mills Park.
Wow. Didn't know that. Yeah. And it goes back even further than that as far as the Indians and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
Using it.
Yeah, Trail Ridge Road, which is the highest paved road in the continental U.S., was originally a fur trading and Indian walking, traversing route, because there's no stretch of the road that is greater than 7% grade. So it's, that seems like a lot for some folks from a more flatland society, but that's not too steep for us in the hills. So, in fact, if you travel along the top of Trail Ridge Road, you'll see some rock formations that are rather unnatural along the top edge of the Trail Ridge Road as you're getting into the 11,500, 12,000 feet range. And those rock formations are 10 yards to 20 yards long, even longer in some cases, just little mounds. But that's what the Indians used to hide behind to ambush the prey as the prey would walk across the overland up there. And it's like prairie up at the top of Trail Ridge Road on the mountains. So there's not any trees or above tree line there.
Yeah, it's all tundra up there.
Yeah, tundra, yeah.
So they probably had a lot of elk up there, I suppose.
For sure, yeah, elk, bighorn sheep. I've seen some coyotes up there, so I'm sure black bears, there were brown bears and grizzlies in the park at that time. About 100 years ago is when the grizzlies kind of left our scene and went north. So a lot of game for the Indians to hunt up there, Arapahos and Utes primarily.
Yeah, right. A lot of history there. And does the park have a season? In other words, is there a time when it opens and closes every year because of winter, or is it open all year round? And what is the season for us that we need to be concerned about as fly fishers?
Yeah, the park is open year-round, as all national parks are for the most part. Trail Ridge Road closes in October the date is certainly seasonal based upon the snows, and opens back up in end of May, depending, again, upon the snow melt. So Trail Ridge Road, you can't go from one side to the other year-round, but that's okay for the fly fisher, because you're either going to come into the park either through the Estes Park Town Way or through Grand Lake primarily. There's other entrances, but those are the two primary jumping-off points. For the fly fisher, there's really two seasons to concern ourselves with. The first season is ice out to ice in, and the second season is ice in to ice out. Let me explain that. The ice out to ice in season is typically May to November, depending upon the altitude, and the higher you go, the longer it takes for ice out to occur. And then essentially the ice in to ice out season is the non-fishing season to the fly fisher. So that's from late November to essentially early May. So we're coming right now into the transitional season where the snows are starting to melt at the lower elevations, water's starting to open up, and fly fishers in the area like myself are starting to get pretty excited to hit those ice out conditions.
Yeah, I know. I live at 8,600 feet, and it was 60 degrees on my deck today, so it was really feeling like spring. You know,
you bet, here. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was, in fact, there's a lake right down here for me that I fish, a private lake, and I was going to go down today to see if it started to ice off yet or not, and so any day now, probably. Good, well, and there's no internal restrictions? I mean, if the water's available, it's fishable as far as Marcos?
Interesting you bring that up. Just because the water is available doesn't mean that it's accessible. And so in the back of the book, I provide a pretty key table for those who are planning those ice out expeditions or multi-day early season backpack trips. And that's that snow-free dates by campsite or by elevation table in the back of the book. And that's really handy to help you plan out two things. One, plan out ice out conditions, and I want to caution, the table doesn't predict ice out conditions, it predicts snow free conditions. So you want to go well ahead of that, what that table might suggest for the location you want to go to. And then secondly, if you don't have the gear to be camping on snow, that table will help you kind of predict, you know, what elevation you should be camping at. So if you want to hit ice out conditions like I plan on doing here over the next 6 to 8 weeks, maybe a little further than that, 8 to 12 weeks. You know, snowshoes are highly recommended in some areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I guess that's very useful information. But what I was kind of talking about is park regulations. Restrictions there?
Yeah. No, not really. Just have to have a Colorado fishing license, and that Colorado fishing license is applicable in the park as a whole.
Okay, so you don't need a special license.
No.
That's non-resident and resident both.
That's right, yeah.
And you do have to, though, pay a fee to get in the park, however.
Yeah, all national parks have an entrance fee. Rocky Mountain National Parks is $20 per day. There's a season pass if you plan on hitting the park many times over. I think it's roughly in the $80 range. I don't know what the price is yet this year. But if you're going to be in the park 4 or 5 times, it's just worth to get a season pass.
Yeah. Now, what types of fish, what species of fish are available to us as fly fishers in the park?
You know, primarily it's all trout, rainbow, brook, brown, Colorado River cutthroat, Yellowstone River cutthroat, greenback, and then a hybridized generic cutthroat, which you'll catch many of those in the streams in the lower elevations.
Is that a natural hybrid or
Well, I don't think it's a stocked hybrid. Stocking hasn't occurred since 1968, so this is probably a naturally occurring hybrid. Rainbows and greenback particularly hybridize well together, from what I've been instructed and told. So I would suspect that if you do catch a hybrid cutthroat, it probably has some rainbow in it.
Now, how do you know it's a hybrid?
Well, you'll get that characteristic cutthroat slash, you know, that orange or crimson under the jaw. You'll get the spotting that's characteristic of a cutthroat, but then you might have that rainbow hue, the pinkish brown, pinkish blue stripe that goes through the middle of the trout. You'll see that pretty clearly. some folks consider the par mark to be indicative of a rainbow hybrid, but I've seen some purebred cutthroat high elevations where no rainbow have ever been historically have the same par mark. So I don't gauge that too heavily.
Okay. Now, tell us a bit about the greenback, because that's kind of a coveted catch, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Really, this is the only place in the world where you're going to find greenback cutthroat. The historic range of greenback cutthroat extended into Wyoming and into southern Colorado, and the efforts are still there today to restore the greenback to its original range, but primarily epicenter is in Rocky Mountain National Park. So if you come to Rocky Mountain National Park, make sure you target some streams or some lakes with greenback cutthroat so you can at least see them and have an opportunity to catch them. Of course, that fish is highly protected, so you want to put it back right away. But it is a beautiful and unique trout that's only found in this area. Yeah.
Is there any particular time of year that you would want to fish for those over other times? Or is it just like a trout in that regard?
Greenback are pretty opportunistic feeders, and they're found in well over half of the fishable water on the east side of the park. So your chances of catching one are great just because of the numbers. And let me put this in context. Back in the late 60s, it is estimated that anywhere between a couple thousand to 4,000 numbers of this fish were found in just one or two streams. That's a pretty low amount for a trout in the high-altitude waters. So the fish was put on a protective list. Restoration efforts began, and so since the early 70s into today, we have a very, very thriving population. It's a historic blueprint for restoring fish species in an indigenous area.
Mm-hmm. So which of the trout are natural? You said that the stocking hasn't gone on for years, so everything's wild there now. But which ones are actually natural to the park?
The two native fish to the park are the Colorado cutthroat and the greenback cutthroat. So brook trout, brown trout, and rainbow trout primarily, which are the most common trout in the United States, were reintroduced since the late 1800s, even into the 1920s, according to some records. So the Yellowstone River cutthroat, which is found in just a couple waters in the park, was also introduced manually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And let's talk about access. You already talked about it a little bit regarding the snow and so forth. And what kind of access do we have in the park? We've got is it mainly walk-wade in most of the fish areas? Is there any boating, any tubing allowed?
Yeah. Let's cover those two areas separately. The first walk-wade scenario is more of a hike and wet-wade, I think is a little more appropriately stated. Most fishing in the park that's worth it, meaning solitude, the things that fly fishers look for, solitude, maybe a bit larger fish, more challenging fishing conditions, requires a hike, not just a walk. Now, the trails are groomed throughout the park, so it's not like you're going off-trail, although you can if you want for some fishing destinations. But for the most part, you're going to follow a trail. It's going to take you to water, and that hike is modest at best. In the park, waders are certainly a creature feature. In the summer, they just aren't needed. You can wet wade in the shoes you hiked in. In fact, wading in a lake, even though I suggest a few things in the book, tactics rather for wading in a lake, I've really, since writing the book in the past couple of years, I've even changed my tune in that short amount of time about wading in a lake. And overall, I find myself rarely wading a lake. I just don't need to. And I'll get into that in a second, why you don't need to. But the harmful aspect is you're ruining insect habitat by wading on a lake bottom, especially when that lake only has a short growing season for insects, from ice out to ice in. So hiking and wading kind of go together, and you can get to anywhere in the park, really. Now, in terms of float tubes and hard craft like kayaks and canoes, they are allowed in the park. However, no motors whatsoever. No electric motors, no gas motors, no anything. And frankly, I don't know who would want to carry all that to a lake. So the average altitude of lakes in the park is 9,600 feet. So you're going to have to hump that quite a ways to make it worth it. Now, I do have a backpackable float tube that's 8-9 pounds, and so I've taken that up to a few lakes on a time or occasion, and frankly I've found that it really has not given me any greater advantage than being on the shore. And I found that when I do take a float tube up to a high mountain lake, I typically am focusing myself of casting back into the shore and stripping usually a subsurface fly back out so that profile of the fly is seen by fish that are cruising. And I'm already spotting the cruising fish anyhow. So I can do that from the shore without having to carry all that equipment up.
Yeah, yeah. What about most of these high mountain lakes don't have a lot of trees around them because they're, I mean, that's a lot of times a problem when you get up there and you're trying to cast and you can't get, you know, you're doing mainly roll casts.
Yeah.
To get out there.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about most high mountain lakes, particularly in Rocky Mountain National Park and many of the other lakes in Colorado that I've visited. In fact, the techniques I discussed tonight will be highly applicable to most any lake or stream of high altitude in Colorado, for that matter.
Okay.
The lakes have a bowler's hat appeal shape to them, so they have a really shallow shoreline that jets out, you know, a few feet to 10, 15 feet, and then you see a drop-off. And that shallow shoreline, where you can see the cruising fish day in and day out, is called the littoral zone. And that littoral zone is where these fish feed. You know, if they're in the deep water, they're essentially not catchable. They're not on the active feed. They're out there to rest, and they're not out there to be tempted or tormented by a slowly trolled deep fly. And I've tried that technic with a float tube, and I brought up a fish finder, and I've marked them, and I've never had luck going out in the deep water. So I focus myself on that littoral zone where you're going to see most of that insect activity and the feeding fish cruising.
Yeah. In fact, you know, we just did an interview with Denny Rickards, and, you know, he's like the stillwater guru out there.
Yeah, yeah, I'm
and
sure.
He just about duplicated what he said word for word, you know. You go deep, and he says, well, you may, if you just put it right in front of their nose, and they may hit it just of spite, but it's just a waste of a lot of time. As he said.
It is,
you know?
It is.
You might as well go have lunch or take a nap and lay in the flowers or something, you know.
Yeah.
and wait, you know, because it's just they just don't hit that often out there. So.
Yeah. You'll see float tubers hitting the lakes at lower altitudes where you're going to have some weed growth, where the water is a bit warmer to support that growth, and that's when you're going to get into scuds and damsels and critters that like the weeds, and particularly if the weeds grow very far out into the lake where you can't cast to it reasonably from shore. But I got to be honest with you, I doubt if I'll ever take a float tube up at a high mountain lake above 9,000 feet again. It's just not worth it to me.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Well, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about Rocky Mountain National Park. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Schweitzer about fly fishing Rocky Mountain National Park. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Steve, at this point in the show, I always ask my guests, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So tell us, what's going on in your fly fishing world?
Well, you know, it's the rivers and lakes at the lower elevations right now of, you know, 6,000 to 8,000 feet are just starting to wake up, and the snow's going away. I've wetted a line a couple times in the local stream that I live near, and I've teased a few trout, but I'm really looking forward to planning those ice out trips in the next couple months here up in the park. So, you know, past couple of years has been a lot of research for the book, so I've gone up with a camera only many times to make sure I get pictures and, you know, additional notes for the book. So it'll be nice now just to put the camera away, put the notebook away, put the recorder away, and just go up with a fly rod and enjoy my day.
And your book.
Yeah.
You better take your book, otherwise you're not going to know where to go.
Hopefully I know what's in the book, yeah.
So, good. And then your book was just published. And where can people get your book? If you'd like?
Yeah, it's just now making its way through the distribution network. And so many of the fly shops in the Front Range area here in Colorado should be stocking it shortly. Orders are starting to come in for that. It is on Amazon. You can get it at the book's website. And we're working on some international distributorship here over the next month or so.
Now, what's the book's website?
The book's website is flyfishingrmnp.com. So that's the acronym for Rocky Mountain National Park. So flyfishingrmnp.com.
Okay, great. Terrific. We did get a question here on the Internet, a few, and one in particular let's talk about because it's about fish in particular. It says, this is David down in Dallas, Texas. He wants to know if you should be keeping the brookies in the park.
You know, that's a great question. Not many people ask that, and it's a point that I make in the book that the fish regulations for the park are rather lucrative and generous for brook trout. I can't recite them off the top of my head, but it's in the neighborhood of 6, 8, or 10 fish you can keep. There is a bonus fish under 8 or 10 inches you can keep. Refer to the book and obviously to the state park regs, but it's not a bad thing to keep brook trout in the park, and I'll tell you why. More often than not, I've seen in the high mountain lakes in the park and in the streams stunted fish. And stunted fish have that characteristic nature to them of a big head, a rather thin or elongated body, and sometimes they're awfully dark. You know, they're not getting the nutrients to brighten them up. So those are the things I look for, and if it's a stunted area, I might keep some fish. Now, I've kept 5 fish in 11 years, so I've not kept my, I guess, fair share or the share allotted to me, but I don't discourage it whatsoever from brook trout.
Okay. Yeah, so just overcrowding is causing the stuntedness.
Yeah, yep.
Mm-hmm. And they're very prolific, as I understand.
They are. It's sort of sad to think that they're a beautiful fish and one of the most beautiful fish in the park, but they're so opportunistic that they overcrowd other fish that should probably have a right to be there as well, like the native fish that are trying to be reintroduced in the park. So you got to make room for them somehow, and you've got to sort of act like God sometimes to make the natural entropy and balance again, and brook trout have definitely overtaken greater than what we've ever thought that they would in the park.
Yeah. Okay, let's see what we got here. Dan in Denver, he says, when does the Colorado River start to fish well in the park? And if I planned a camping trip, when would be a time after ice out on high mountain lakes? Maybe you can speak to that generally, because I know in your book you address that specifically.
Yeah, really the best time to fish the Colorado River is as soon as the river starts flowing freely and the ice is off, which it can be as early as now. Now, I have not been on the western side of the park yet this spring, so I can't speak to the Kawanichi Valley, which is essentially where the Colorado River flows through, but I know that it does open up earlier than most waters, and I've had great success when I've had to tramp through snow, you know, up to my waist to get to the river. Now, you won't see the river in the Kawanichi Valley when there's snow that deep, so trust me, just walk. Just keep on walking until you hit water, and then you know that's the river.
A little chilly, huh?
yeah. But, you know, maybe to be a little more thorough in the answer, it certainly varies by altitude, particularly when we're talking about ice out on high-altitude lakes, which I believe was his second part to his question.
Yeah.
But I would start targeting the second or third week of June as a start. You know, I do give more detailed data in the back of the book to help you plan that, but as a rule of thumb, second or third week of June, you'll start hitting ice out in these lakes.
And either bring your snowshoes or your yak tracks, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny because that time of year, you know, a lot of the high mountain trails, you know, you can be dry trail and then you'll hit a, you know, 6-foot snow drift that you have to get across and then dry trail again. And, you know, you never know what you're going to get, kind of.
Yeah. I do want to caution folks, when you're hiking up in the park looking for those ice out conditions, you will go across these 6-foot snow banks that you would think would be solid underneath, but you'll post hole through them pretty quickly that time of year. The snow becomes quickly unstable. But more importantly, do not use those as bridges to go across flowing water underneath. That just invites trouble and may get you in serious, serious danger.
Yeah. There's definitely, you know, extreme chance of hypothermia up there. You get wet like that. And in fact, they did. I went to a hunter safety course once, and one of the case studies in that was, and this was in the summer, where a fisherman was about a mile and a half upriver from his car, fell in the river, and headed his way back to the car because he was soaking wet, and, you know, just a little breeze puts on the windshield, and he's starting to go hypothermic, and they ended up finding him about a half a mile from his car sitting up against a tree, and he just died of hypothermia.
Yeah.
This was in the summer, you know.
Imagine,
you know, in the spring when much chillier, you're really at great risk.
You could easily make a snowball year-round in the park, just to let folks that have not been to the park before know that there's snow year-round in the park.
And the other thing in the Rockies that I know from experience is because you're so high up, you can't see over the mountain. So it can be clear blue skies, and 2 hours later you can be in a blizzard, you know, and the weather comes over the mountain, you don't see it coming, and all of a sudden you're in it. You know?
Absolutely. That's great advice. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's happened to me a number of times.
Yeah.
In fact, we were up at the Flat Tops Wilderness area one summer, and it was the second week in July, and we met the rangers coming down the mountains, and they stopped us, and they said, "Are you guys prepared for winter camping?"
Yeah.
And we said, "Oh, yeah." Well, we weren't, but we said,
right,
"Oh, yeah."
Right.
And sure enough, we went over the pass, and it wasn't quite, it was freezing rain, but pretty miserable. So you don't know what you're going to get. Okay, while we were talking, we got one in on the internet that says Chuck Campbell in Buffalo says, "What's the latest time of year you can fish the high mountain lakes and streams?" And again, maybe you could talk just generally.
Sure.
Sure.
You can. I have fished higher altitude lakes, meaning at the 10,000 foot range, clear into November, almost Thanksgiving. But it's certainly dependent upon the weather that we have up to that point. But typically, when you start getting into November, lakes are starting to freeze over. You get that thin sheet of ice during the daytime, and then by noon it's gone. And then before you know it, a week later, you get that thin sheet of ice, and then only half of it melts, and then all of a sudden you've got a thin sheet of ice that stays in the lake year-round, and then you're doomed for fly fishing beyond that. But certainly October is wide open, but I'll caution you, the weather gets much more squirrely the higher you go in October, so be prepared, like, you know, Roger, like you just said.
Yeah, right. Silas Gray in Missouri asks, "I've got a week off. When should I come to the park?"
That's a wide-open question. Let me interpret that question as saying, "Steve, what's your favorite time to go to the park if I had a week?" And I'll answer it that way. If you have a week off and you have flexibility, I would choose late August and any time in September. And the reason being is certainly have less crowds, and you're not adding to the problem, right? The problem of crowding, finding a parking spot at a trailhead. And frankly, in September, you've got great caddis hatches. The trestrels are still really hot and heavy, so you're fishing on top just as if you were in July and August. So, you know, late August into September, and you miss all the school kids. So.
Right, and I know after what Labor Day, then most of those parks clear out rather dramatically.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. And then, and this is an important question, too, Jeff in Colorado Springs, since I'm planning a backcountry fly fishing trip into Rocky Mountain National Park this summer. How early in advance do backcountry camping sites fill up?
Hey, Jeff, stop listening to the show and call right now. And that's a funny way of saying that most of the park backcountry sites fill up already by now. The phone lines open March 1st, and they go through, I think they open up for 6 weeks for phone reservations, and then after that you have to mail in or stop into a park office. So it becomes more cumbersome for those who are out of state. In fact, I did call March 1st right at 8 a.m. when the lines opened up. It took me 6 hours to get through, and I did not get my second reservation already for a rather remote spot in the park. So I had to go to my third and fourth options before I filled a reservation and could plan my trip. So, Jeff, I'd hustle if I were you.
Yeah, and especially if you want a decent place. I know a few years ago my son and I went up and, you know, we reserved a camping spot. And when we got up there, it was in the middle of a burned-out forest. Wasn't too nice.
Wow, yeah, that's not pleasant, is it?
No, and it was pouring rain, and of course there was no firewood or anything, you know, and it was miserable. We came around and packed out the next morning.
But, right.
But yeah, you do a little research first, too, to know where you're going and whether or not it's, you know.
Yeah,
been a fire or something like that happened. And we didn't even think to ask about that, you know, but now I will.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Just to be forewarned, you may get up to your camping spot and find somebody in it. That happened to me once, too.
Yeah, there occasionally you'll find that, but for the most part, it's an honest mix-up, and people, you know, there's many campsites in one location oftentimes, and they may have a reservation for the other one, so.
Yeah, they. I'm sure it was more of a mix-up from the reservation standpoint. It wasn't the people involved, but anyway, we had to regroup and figure out what we were going to do then, and try to make camp in a good place that didn't, you know, destroy anything.
Yeah.
You have, you mentioned already one of the charts in your book, but you have a couple of charts in your book that I think are just invaluable. And one is the Creeks, Streams, Rivers, and Lakes chart, and then the other is the 20-year average snow-free date by backcountry campsite chart. Can you explain those two charts and how one should use those effectively?
Sure. We've already had a few questions tonight about folks planning a backcountry multi-day trip. Well, you'll probably want to know if you plan a backcountry multi-day trip, and are the waters that I'm targeting, do they have fish in them, and then what kind of fish are they? Well, that's the creeks, streams, rivers, and lakes chart that I put in the back of the book. I list all the named waters that are perennial flowing, and whether they have fish in them or not, and then what type of fish. I also give you a few pieces of information, such as the altitude of the lake or the length of the trail and the trailhead to take to get up to where that destination is in the chart. So that's pretty important to know whether you're going up where there's fish or not.
Right.
And when I started research for this book, I hit too many waters that were fishless. Didn't know it. There weren't a lot of pieces of data available to me 10, 11 years ago that would clearly indicate if there were fish or not in a certain water. Second thing that you mentioned, I believe, was the average snow-free date by backcountry campsite. And we've touched upon that a little bit already, but again, I want to caution, it's the snow-free date by campsite, so in essence, by elevation, not the ice-out date by elevation. But you can use that snow-free data to predict when ice out will be at a certain elevation. So I think that's pretty helpful for those eager locals that might want to get up there and do some ice out fishing.
Right, right. Yeah, I thought that, it's pretty cool. I mean, just looking at the chart on the stream, you know, creek, streams, rivers, and lakes to say, well, I want to go fish for greenback or cutthroat. And I mean, you can just dial into where, you know, a bunch of possibilities. And I know from experience, I've been into a lot of high mountain lakes that were probably barren, you know, but not knowing it, wasted an hour there, you know, trying to fish them. So
yeah.
That too, to me, that column in the chart is really, really valuable. So
Yeah.
Well, good. We need to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about equipment and flies and hatches and so forth up there and see what we've got up there. So stick with us, folks. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on U.S. 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Steve Schweitzer about fly fishing Rocky Mountain National Park. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll get your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay. We got Chris in Evergreen, Colorado, just down the road from me. I've only been fly fishing about 2.5 years. mainly on larger rivers and streams. I'm interested in fishing for brook trout and cutthroat this summer in Rocky Mountain National Park. I'm thinking about equipment. What is a good length and size rod reel combo? I know I own a 9-foot 5-weight, which seems like overkill for catching small brookies and cutthroat. So what would you suggest to fish the park with?
Yeah, it may be overkill on some smaller streams for the brook trout. You'll definitely have plenty of muscle to skate them into you. But for cutthroat, you know, when you get up in the higher elevations where cutthroat live, the cutthroat can be much bigger, you know, in the 20, 22-inch range, upwards of 5 pounds. You know, you just have to put in your time to get them, for sure. It's just like any water. The big fish are there. You just have to really put your time in to go get them. So I would say that 9-foot 5-weight is perfect for the lakes you hike to. One thing we haven't talked about is you are going to encounter wind at any given time on a lake in any given day in the summer. And that's just due to the fact that the lower elevations are heating up, and those adiabatic winds kick up, and they start blowing upwards. And when they hit that cooler air above those lakes, it just causes a swirl. It gets pretty windy. And as a byproduct of that, they drop ants and beetles and small terrestrials in on the lakes. And that's something Gary LaFontaine wrote about many years ago, the adiabatic winds are your friends. And that's for sure. I just love it when it gets windy. That doesn't scare me a bit. But you're going to need a bigger rod to handle that. For streams, a 3 or 4 weight and a 7 to 8 foot length is just perfect. You don't need to have anything fancy there.
To clarify also with other floating equipment, we talked about kayaks and float tubes. With Silas Gray asks, is there anywhere to use it? Let me extend that question and say, are there any restrictions? If you're willing to take a backpack float tube up to these lakes, are there lakes that you can't put a tube on, or are they all open to tubing?
They're all open to tubing, kayaks and canoes. I have never seen anybody with a kayak or canoe hiking up a trail.
Right.
I've seen float tubes for sure. There's a few drive-by type fishing opportunities where a kayak or a canoe would be helpful in those, Lily Lake and Sprague Lake, although I've never even seen a hard-bodied device on Sprague Lake. So there is one lake in the park, though, that does not allow any fishing or any boats of any kind, and that's Bear Lake, right near the Bear Lake parking area.
And that's, right next to a parking lot, basically.
Yeah.
That'd turn into a circus, I suppose, if they go through there. And then what would you, we've talked a bit about, weather and so forth. What clothing or gear, if you're going to do these even just one-day hikes up and back, what do you usually take with you to protect yourself against foul weather and and that kind of thing?
I'll stick towards the vacation months of late June, July, August, September. That's when that's 70% of the visitorship comes there, so I think that'll apply to most of the listeners tonight. But, I'll go up in shorts or convertible pants if it seems to be an inclement day, so I can take off the bottoms if it does turn out to be a good day. I'll hike in Gore-Tex-lined comfortable hiking shoes, and I typically rock hop when I'm on streams or on the banks of a lake. I rarely have to get in to get wet. Occasionally, I'll see some cruising fish that I just have to have, right? I just have to cast to them. So I will position myself in the water for a more advantageous cast, and I'll get myself wet. But I got to be honest with you, that water in the middle of the summer in those lakes is darn cold, and after 15 minutes, you're going to be wanting to get out to warm up. So I don't take any waders or anything like that. In terms of extras I put in my fly pouch or my fanny pack, certainly water or a water filter if I'm going to be up there for a really long day. Just do not short yourself of water. That's a necessity up there. I'll put a sandwich or a candy bar or something in there to keep me active during the day with a little extra sugar. But most fly fishers have found out, your hunger goes away if you're catching fish, and all of a sudden you realize you're hungry only when you're walking back to the car. So that's when the candy bar is kind of helpful. And I definitely take a rain jacket, a waterproof rain jacket, and not a thin one, not a windbreaker. because I would say one out of every 8 or 10 trips I go up in the park, I get hailed on. And so a thicker rain jacket is extra protection that I just huddle under, when I get pelted with that hail.
Yeah. Question came in on the internet. Now is as good a time as any to address this. David in Dallas says, what about a recommendation for the YMCA of the Rockies as a place for families to stay up there? And can you just kind of, for out-of-town folks, kind of address the where-to-stay issue?
Yeah, there is so many cabins, and YMCA of the Rockies is a great location for families for sure, because they have other activities besides fly fishing. They have horseback riding and hiking, and they run a music festival, a music camp certain times of the year. Artists come in, so they try to appeal to all lovers of the park and the park area. If you want to camp but not go in the park, there are plenty of campgrounds just outside the park that allow you to pitch a tent, and you can smell the night air and get all the experience of high altitude camping right out the back of your car for those who can't hike, for example, too far. There's plenty of trailer hookups and trailer opportunities throughout the area. Cabins you can rent right on the Big Thompson and the Fall River that come out of the park. So the best thing to do is to search Estes Park Campgrounds and Estes Park Hotels on the internet, and you'll get just a slew of responses there.
The other option, too, I think, is on the west side, over by Grand Lake. You could use that kind of a staging area, couldn't you, to get the western slope?
Absolutely. The same thing applies from the Estes Park side. Just search for Grand Lake if you want to be on the western part of the site. So someone asked earlier about fishing the Colorado River and the Kawanichi Valley and so forth, and that's the jumping-off point, is to stay in Grand Lake.
Yeah. Let's talk about food and flies up there. What types of insects are in the streams and lakes up there that we should be concerned with as fly fishers? And maybe you can kind of run through the general hatch seasons up there, because it's somewhat compressed, I would think.
It is. Just purely because of ice in, ice out conditions, there's really two hatch seasons to worry yourself with. One is October through May, which there's frankly no hatching going on of any concern to a fly fisherman, although in May you might get a few hatches in the lower elevations. But the real hatches of caddis and yellow sallies, tiny, small, yellow-green stoneflies, yellow stoneflies in the size 10, size 12. You've got ants and hoppers and crickets and beetles. This is all in June through September time frame. And the later it gets into that time frame, August, September, the more the terrestrial becomes important to you as a fishing arsenal.
Yeah, I know a lot of locals do really well with beetles up there.
Yeah.
I seem to think that's a really hot fly in the park.
Yep.
Which leads us to Jack's question in Cheyenne, and he asks, if you can only have 5 different flies to fish with year-round up there, and he's speaking of just the Rockies, or let's just speak of the park specifically, what flies would you have in your box if there was just 5?
That's a good question, because these are the 5 flies that I never go without in the park. Certainly a caddis dry, and I'll stick to the flavor of fly. I won't stick to the pattern, because the pattern is a very personal choice. There's a lot of great caddis dry patterns out there, but a size 14 caddis, size 12 or 14 hopper pattern, whatever favorite flavor you want. Definitely an ant, and I've chosen that over a beetle. I like the ant just a little better. A woolly bugger for those days that you just can't get somebody to come up, and a midge. And that kind of leads into a midge size 18 or 20 and black, something dark. And this, year-round on these lakes, I shouldn't say year-round, but when it's ice out, the lakes are always producing midges. And you'll see fish rise, and it'll frustrate you, and you don't know what they're rising to. It'll even rise right in front of you, and you didn't see what they took. Assuming it's not a subsurface rise, where they're taking an emerger just before it hits the surface, and it's a dry fly, it's probably a midge, and it's probably a small black one. So if you have those frustrating days, I have a rule of thumb, go black and go small. as small as you can, and start there, and then work your way back up until you dial into the size of fly that they're looking for.
Well, what's interesting is what you just, three out of five were terrestrials.
Oh, yeah.
You just mentioned. So yeah. A lot of topwater action going on.
Yeah.
A lot of exciting fishing. Huh?
The park has a reputation of small fish and easy to catch fish, and that is certainly true for the lower altitude rivers and not necessarily the lakes. So it's a great training bed to take your family out and just fling a fly rod, and oftentimes the fish just aren't too spooked about an errant cast, and they'll come right back and you can get to them again. But the higher you go, the more challenging the conditions are, the fish become more like the trout that you come to love in Colorado and in Wyoming and in the West, where they become more picky. But the higher you go, also those anabatic winds are bringing those terrestrials up there, and you're wondering, how the heck did a beetle get up here in this lake when I know it reaches freezing at night? It's because those winds load up there, and be prepared with terrestrials at high altitude lakes. It's a great thing to have in your fly box.
They, a lot of times I'll be driving on Friday, and they have on public radio, they have Science Fridays or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it's called. But so they talk about all kinds of scientific things. And one Friday they were talking about the number of insects that are in the high air currents around the Earth. And it was incredible numbers. And I'm not talking about like 1,000 feet up. I'm talking about like 20,000 feet up in the air. Of millions and trillions of insects going around the Earth up there, and then they drop in somewhere. Like
ask the pilots. Pilots in our audience should know.
Amazing numbers of insects up there. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
But, well, let's talk about strategies and tactics a little bit. Why don't you give us, you already mentioned about being careful about protecting the lakes and waiting. So anything else you want to tell us about lake wading techniques and tips on fishing the high mountain lakes that you use, technique, tactic-wise?
Sure. One thing you don't want to do is rush up on a lake once you get there after a five-mile hike and you're like, oh, I'm excited, I'm here already, let's start flinging a fly rod. One tactic I use to calm myself down and resist that temptation to just start flinging to the first fish you see is I don't put my rod together until I get to the lake. And my hiking is usually I'm destination driven, so I don't fish the water along the way. Oftentimes a trail will follow the stream. Well, I just resist that temptation. I go right up to the lake I want to fish because I want to get there as early as possible and fish that lake before noon as many hours as I can get in. And after noon, things change in the lake. The fish feeding habits change, and you got to kind of relearn the lake. Not to say that you can't catch fish, but I just find the early morning to be more productive. Late at night as well, but most of the time, as a day hiker, you're gone by dusk. You want to get back to your car before it gets too dark. So unless you're camping up there, the early morning is your best bet. Typically, wading is not necessary, as I discussed earlier. Look for that littoral zone, so that's the shallow zone around the rim of a lake. That's where all your bugs are going to live because the water is typically warmer there. The sun hits it and helps them grow. And you're going to see fish cruise. These are the typical cruising fish. They are so predictable. And so as you're putting your rod together, as you get to that lake, pay attention to the fish that are cruising in your area. And they have a pattern about them, and they'll be in packs of two or three, all right? And sometimes you'll get some bigger fish cruising together and some smaller fish cruising together, so be patient. You might have a bigger pack of two or three come by your way. If you're not in position to cast them when they come by, just wait. They'll come back. It could be 2 minutes, could be 5 minutes, could be 10 minutes. They all have their different cycles. But they do pattern. They do cruise the same circuits, and they all respect each other. And when they come back, be ready for them.
And then what? I think we already addressed the float tube issue. You said mainly you get out and fish back towards the shore. Is that
If you do take a float tube up, you're still going to focus on that littoral zone, that shallow zone around the edge of a lake. You just go 10 to 15 yards out, and you cast in. Showing the if you're dragging a streamer of some sort or a nymph, you want to show that perpendicular, that fly perpendicular to the shoreline. So you're showing that profile. If you're going with with the shoreline, you're less effective. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Now there is a situation if you're in a float tube and you want to be parallel to the shore, and that's when you're fishing that drop off, because there are lurking trout that are much larger that hang just off the edge of that drop off, and they're in that zone where you're saying, well, I don't know if they're too deep. And if they're resting and I can't see them, or they might be under a rock ledge right at that drop-off and just waiting to ambush something that comes by. But occasionally, you'll get those bigger fish right off at that ledge, even on a dry fly. They'll come out of nowhere and just surprise you. So, don't fall asleep in your float tube like I've been known to do. And there's a picture of a greenback cutthroat that I put in the park. It was an 18-inch cutthroat, 3-plus pounds-ish. It was a very one of my best cutthroat ever in the park. And I got it by dredging a very, very small woolly bugger, like a size 12, right on the edge of a drop-off that I could access from shore. And he came out of nowhere. I had no idea he was there, but I was very fortunate that day.
Yeah, yeah. You got to get lucky once in a while, Steve.
That's right, yeah. Makes for good pictures.
Okay, we need to take a quick break here, and then we'll come back and talk more about where to fish in the park. And also, we've got some other questions came in on the Internet I want to address and get those handled. So we'll be right back, folks. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers Online Magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Steve Schweitzer about fly fishing Rocky Mountain National Park. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage and use that Q&A text box there to ask your question. Send your question in, and we'll answer as many of them as possible as on the show tonight as we can. Okay, a couple questions came in on the Internet I want to get to. Jerry Davis in Helena, Montana asks, has there been an effort to reintroduce the native cutthroat within the park, and for that matter within the Rocky Mountain Front Range, Colorado? I know in Montana there's been an effort to kill off the hybrid populations of cutthroat rainbows in high mountain lakes and reintroduce the West Slope cutthroat.
Yeah, the efforts have really been focused on the greenback cutthroat and the Colorado River cutthroat, which are native to the park. And so that you're going to see them to be most prolific in most of the waters in the park. Interestingly, though, the greenback cutthroat is only found on the east side of the Continental Divide. So if you're focusing on fishing the west side of the Continental Divide, you're not going to find any greenback cutthroat that we know of as a fisheries enthusiast in the park. But you will find plenty of Colorado River cutthroat on the west side.
Okay. And these are just some random questions came in on the Internet. Steve's background includes work with Dr. Tom Whiting at Whiting Farms. Would you ask him to talk about the use of hackle by hairdressers and the supposed shortage of hackle for fly tires?
Oh, that's a whole show in itself.
Yeah?
the fashion industry has hit the hackle industry by storm. Suffice it to say, the fashion industry can suck up the entire hackle industry production in one day. That's the difference in size of the two industries. I have written an article to appear in one of the industry trade magazines here shortly, kind of exposing all of the impacts to the fly fisher, the fly tire, the commercial fly tire, anybody in the industry. So we'll make sure that we get that information out.
Can't you just encourage Tom not to sell to those people?
we've had lots of discussions like that as an industry with not only Tom but the other major hackle growers as well.
Yeah, yeah. Or give them the leftovers or something.
Yeah, they're just going in hair, right? Not on flies.
Right. I want to thank Dick in Northbrook, Illinois, for that question. I don't think I credited him for that. And let's see, a couple others here I want to get. Jerry Davis in Helena wants to know if you've seen any wolves in the park in the past few years.
Wow. You know, last year I was on the north edge of the park, and I was fishing a very remote stream that it had just rained, and the banks, the sandy banks of the stream, were completely smooth from the rain. No footprints whatsoever. I fished down, and then I said, okay, I got to turn around. I got to get in the car and go back home. I fished back up, and where my foot had landed in a particular stretch of that sand where I'd walked along the bank, right next to it then, was a large, large print of about 5 inches across. And in the park, no dogs are allowed. So I make the assumption that there are no dogs in the park at that point in time of the day. I didn't see any other human prints, so if it was a dog, it was a stray dog. I took a picture of the prints, put my reel and rod next to it to give a size perspective, and I've put it against some experts in the area. It's really unknown what that print was, but it has been documented in northern Colorado. Some wolves that have been released in Yellowstone, tagged wolves, have been found in northern Colorado. So it's not unlikely that the wolves could be in the park.
Yeah, yeah. What about moose? Are moose?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Coming on there strong?
Yeah, it's great to see. Well over 100 documented moose in the park now, most of them on the western side of the Continental Divide, although there have been some documented moose on the eastern side of the park now, which is wonderful news that they're starting to use the entire park as their playland.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you, too, about stream fishing techniques that you might have, and we do have a couple, let's see, well, we have one question here from David Watkins. Well, this might be extreme. Any suggestions for catching those fish in the pools on the far side of the moraine? I always seem to spook them. And you might address spooking because we're dealing with gin clear streams and lakes up there where they can see you, you can see them. So what? How do we deal with that?
When those fish are in the pools and the pools have a glass surface to them, there's not much you can do unless you crawl on your hands and knees and get in there, and I've done that, you know, combat fishing, where you're really low, and yet when you just raise to cast your rod, either your rod tip flashes or you make a bang on the bank, and those sound waves that you're making on the bank just reverberate through water like nobody's business. So it's a tough proposition to get to them when they're in those slack water. However, if you position yourself so that you're behind them, obviously, you have a better chance to get to them, and wait until the wind kicks up so you have a little ripple in the water and you give yourself a fighting chance to get to them.
Mm. Okay. And what any other stream fishing techniques in particular?
Essentially in the park, hit every piece of pocket water you can find with a dry fly in the summer. You'd be surprised the size of fish that live in the smallest of kitchen sink little pools and areas behind boulders and in the middle of a stream even. Just fish anything that textbooks instruct you to fish where fish might live. Something that's really coming on strong in the park is tenkara fishing, where it's essentially a extendable rod with a fixed leader that you dap your fly on the water. You know, kind of reverting back to techniques in the 1700s. So I essentially do that without the tenkara rod equipment, where I have a fixed leader of 4 feet. And that leader extends out of my rod just enough so I can dap it on the ground, on the water surface in small streams, and I just reach out with a 7 or 8 foot rod, and I never cast whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. A lot of places like that, those little brooks going through the high mountain meadows and so forth.
That's right.
I mean, a lot of times I can't even see in there, and I just stick it over, you know.
That's exactly
over
right.
The grass, and sure enough, there's somebody there.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. Just fish the water you don't think might have fish, and all of a sudden you'll be rewarded.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit. In your book, you broke, because the park's rather big, And you broke it down into, what was it, 8 zones, I think
yeah.
you did?
Yeah.
You want to talk about those 8 zones and what they mean to us? Are there some that are kind of places that you wouldn't frequent or more remote? Or, you know, kind of give us the feature set maybe of each one and where they are in the park. And I think you kind of go clockwise around the park, don't you?
I do. It was rather arbitrary coming up with 8 zones. I could have come up with 4 or 5 just as easily, but I found the 8 zones were more applicable where the zones meet in the middle using the Continental Divide as the common border, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So you got west of the divide and east of the divide.
Yeah, and then I also considered other factors such as geography, trail accessibility, types of fish. So I kind of found that 8 serviced all those criteria well. And each of the areas have a certain geographic feel to them, geologic feel to them as well. You know, up in the northern section of the park, the zones up there are much more remote. There's only one way really in there, actually 2 ways. You hike up from a more southern trail accessible route, or you drive up to the Long Draw Reservoir area and you come down Corral Creek and you hike into the park that way. It's really remote and big open meadows and big rolling mountains, and the water is sometimes big. It depends on which ones you hit. But
sounds like that may be more geared for multi-day
backpacking
trips.
Yeah. And then in the middle of the park, there's a couple zones in the middle of the park that extend both on the west side and the east side. They're very much alike. You've got meadow stream fishing. So on the middle section of the western side, you've got Kawanichi Valley and the Nahu Creek, which dumps into the Kawanichi Valley. That's 13 miles of fishing, essentially prairie land, stream flowing, Oxbow Stream. It's just beautiful, beautiful water. You can be, you know, have solitude day of fishing, 5 minute walk from your car, and then on the eastern side you've got the moraine park, you got the couple valleys, the Fall River, Hollowell Park area, and then the moraine park area, which offers some great meadow stream fishing. Then in the southern area you got a couple zones that these are the wild zones. The southern area of the park is really wild. On the east side, it's relatively accessible through Allen's Park and the Wild Basin Trailhead area on the east side.
Now, is this what you're talking, Zone 4?
I believe so. I don't have the map in front of me, but I believe it's Zone 4 and 5.
Bear Lake in it and Sprague Lake. And
yeah, even south of that. Yep.
Okay, so Zone 5 potentially.
Yep.
Yeah, Wild Basin.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And then on the western side of the park, you've got a couple trailheads down near Grand Lake, East Inlet, Tanahutu Creek, North Inlet Trail, which are just wonderful fishing areas. In the west side of the park, it's less traffic. So
Yeah, because you have to go either over Trail Ridge Road or go around through Winter Park and Granby to get over there. I know we did a multi-day trip out of, I'm trying to remember the name of the trailhead, but it's maybe it's East Inlet, and then it was a multi-day. We went through the valleys up there, climbed, walked along the divide, and then dropped in and came out over there by Bear Lake, I think it was.
Yep.
And nice trip. Saw moose on that trip.
Yeah, for the hardy fly fisher, you can walk across the park in one day. It's not overly big where it's insurmountable, but if you want to do that, it's either you hike or you fish, but you can't do both.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that takes too much time. So we do have some questions like, this one came in on the Internet, Bob in Fort Collins. He says, Steve, what's the most favorite single-day destination to fish that for you?
I have any one of 3. They're all on the west side of the park. It's the Tanahutu Creek, North Inlet, or East Inlet trails. And just because it's big country, you have a variety of water you can fish, both lakes, meadows, fast-flowing pocket water and streams and dense cover. It's just whatever you want to choose. It's right there within a couple hours walk. The only thing is, for me who lives on the east side of the park, it's quite a drive in the morning to get over there if I went to fish early.
Yeah, yeah. We also have Dave in Gilpin County says best hour to 2 hour hike destinations. Fish and wanting to know about the fish and their tactics to catch them. Is that, would that be the same area for you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
On the east side, you know, you got the Roaring River, Glacier Creek, Wild Basin, Fern Lake trails that fit into that 1 to 2 hour hike destination categorization that he's asking for. And on the west side, again, East Inlet, Tanahutu, North Inlet, and the Kawanichi Valley. Heck, if I don't want to hike, I can just walk 5 minutes, hit the stream, and just fish all day.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Richard Rupp in Beach Park, Illinois, says, I always hear about the small stream fishing in the park. It must be getting more popular. I like this type of fishing for the solitude and numbers of eager fish. I do not worry about the size of the fish. Is it still possible to get away on a single day's fishing, not overnight, hiking, camping? Could you estimate the total number of miles and streams in the park that fall into this category? And that's kind of what you were just talking about, right?
Yeah.
Just getting 5 minutes away, you're into this.
I have a kind of a rule of thumb that if you're willing to hike in that 1.5 to 2 hour circle away from the trailhead, you've just bypassed a majority, like 95% of the people who hike the trail as a day excursion, non-fly fishing type. You know, they're out there with their family, or they're just they're from the lowlands, maybe their first day in the park, not really attuned to the altitude. So they're going to go about an hour out and an hour back, and that really satisfies them. If you get past that, and you'll know it, you'll just know it on the trail you're at, all of a sudden you just won't have anybody around you. That's when you jump off and start fishing, because you've just bypassed everybody else.
Yep, yep, good advice. Okay, we've got Rick in southeast Pennsylvania, and Rick says, if one only has 8 hours to fish Rocky Mountain National Park and needed to have a great success, what date should one go? Where precisely would you place yourself and stand? And most of all, what method, dry, wet, nymph, hopper, copper, dropper? Do the fish particularly have names in that area? So obviously he's joking, but you know those East Coast guys, Steve, you know, it's like New York City. You can get takeout anywhere, whatever you want. And I think Rick probably just have, you know, prefer to have the fish delivered to his door, you know, like takeout or something. You know?
I have a suspicion that I know who this Rick is, and he's loaded the bag here. If it's the Rick I think of, I've fished with him many times, and he's taught me a thing or two. He does mention something rather serious. You know, when do I choose a dry, a wet, a nymph, you know, hopper, copper, dropper? Frankly, those all work in the summer. It's techniques agnostic on a stream, but I often just go for a dry fly on top to make it easy.
So, Rick, thanks for your humor anyway. We,
yeah.
We like to play with you guys. Let's see here. We talked about the cutthroat species. Let's see what else we got here online. We've got a few more. Carl was asking, do you only fish lakes? And no, you talked about fishing streams as well, right?
Yeah. I actually try to, when I plan a hike for a day, one thing is I don't try to short myself. I give myself at least a half a day, which is a 4 to 5 hour window. Other than that, it's very difficult to get any quality fishing in. If you're going out for less than that, if I have a whole day, then I try to pick a stream or pick a trail that gives me stream fishing and lake fishing, so I have a taste of both.
Yeah, yeah, a little mix it up there.
Yep.
Ron in Folsom, California, asks, what technique presentation do you use, and how does it change as you move up in elevation, specific retrieves or anything? Does that have any effect? Do things change as you go up by 1,000, 2,000 feet?
I don't know if I can characterize that. Once you fish in a high-altitude lake, which I'm saying at 9,500 to 10,000 feet and higher, they tend to all fish the same, according to my research. So I wouldn't change a thing.
And I'm looking at reading through these questions here. Okay, this is Lane in Antioch. He says, and we'll end the show with this one because we're running out of time, but this is going to be a tough one on you.
Okay.
He says, if I could only take one, and these are quite different, so that's why it's kind of tough.
Okay.
If I could only take one trip this year, what would be the advantages of coming out to Rocky Mountain National Park rather than go to some place like Yellowstone?
I don't know.
That's kind of a fair question.
I've actually spent some time in Yellowstone over the course of the years. Yellowstone's much more wide open and requires a lot of hiking to get into some areas where the fishing is really quality. Not to say that the rivers that walk through the meadows near the roadside, you can't catch fish, but I'm talking quality fish, bigger fish. The lakes and rivers in Rocky Mountain National Park are more condensed, and you'll go through more water, or pass more water on less miles of trails. So you're essentially giving yourself more fishing opportunity by hitting the park.
Okay, fair enough. Different topography, too, as far as the views you get is much different in Yellowstone.
And, yeah.
The Rocky Mountain National Park is very rugged and, beautiful, high mountain. Peaks and stuff.
It's a young park in geologic times.
Right. And less chance of getting, sucked into a cauldron than...
or getting boiled. Yeah, exactly.
So both beautiful places, though.
Yeah.
We're lucky to have them out here in the Rockies. So, well, unfortunately, we're out of time, Steve. So we got to wrap things up. But when we return, we're going to be giving away some of our prizes. One year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and 1 year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. Of course, we'll also be giving away your book, A Fly Fishing Guide to Rocky Mountain National Park, which will be a great addition to anybody's library that's going to fish the park. So if you want to win that, stick with us just a few more minutes, and we'll give those prizes away, and maybe you'll be a lucky winner. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and learn more about how you can help their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or you can call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. And now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners of our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. So if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late at this point. But make sure you do it for the next show, because we're always giving away great gifts, and maybe your chance to get lucky and get one of these gifts. So the first, and if you do win, by the way, we will contact you by email to get your information so that we can get that gift off to you. The first thing we're going to give away tonight is 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and that goes to Josh Bassett in Michigan. So congratulations, Josh, on winning that 1 year membership to the Federation. If you aren't a member, you're really going to enjoy this. If you are, we'll get it extended for another year on your current membership, and congratulations. Our next prize that we're going to give away is a 1 year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. Fly Fusion magazine. If you want to know more about Fly Fusion magazine, you can go to flyfusionmag.com. flyfusionmag.com. And boy, this is real close. The Five Fusion is out of Calgary, Canada, and our winner tonight is a Canadian, and it is Lauren Leone in British Columbia. So, Lauren, I may be mispronouncing in British Columbia. Congratulations on that Fly Fusion magazine. And again, if you already have a subscription, we'll get you extended. But enjoy. Great magazine, lots of beautiful photography, really high quality, and everybody should take a look. Okay, now, got those two taken care of. So now we need to deal with and give away Steve's book, Fly Fishing Guide to Rocky Mountain National Park. And for those of you who don't win, again, Steve said it was available on Amazon and on the website, www.flyfishingrmnp.com, flyfishingrmnp.com. So if you aren't one of the lucky, if you aren't the lucky winner tonight, then you're going to have to go one of those places, or your local fly shop too, maybe, as Steve said, getting them in now. So, okay, so the question is for to win Steve's book tonight is two-part. I'm making these harder nowadays because it's been so easy in the past, so I'm doing two-part questions now to really make sure these people are paying attention. So, two-part question. Steve had a favorite time of year to fish. When is it? Fish the park, when is it? And what is the name of the zone that you have to work when you're in high mountain lakes? Okay? Steve's favorite time of year to fish the park, and what zone do you need to fish in high mountain lakes? Is that clear enough, Steve?
It is.
Okay. Well, listen, and I'm going to read some of these answers to you, and you're going to help me out, tell me if they're right or, you know, if they're going to qualify for your book here. But
okay.
First one that came in, it says summer and west. I don't think that quite gets it. Do you?
No, not quite. No. A little more detailed.
Yeah, need more detail on that one. September and alpine zone.
Oh, so close, but we'll take the next one.
September 7th. No. That's my daughter's birthday. It really is. Okay, hey, I made it hard tonight for him, Steve.
Yeah.
Okay, this is getting really close, but I want it more specific, too. This is summer and littoral zone.
Yeah, again, pretty close, but let's dial in a little further.
Yeah, let's see if we can get a little closer to this. Oh, here we go, here we go. August, September, littoral zone.
You bet, right there.
Okay. Jeff Burgess, Fort Collins. Hey, it's right by the park almost.
That is. We may have to meet for a cup of coffee, and I'll personalize it for him.
There you go. There you go. So, Jeff Burgess, you got it spot on here, and you're the winner of Steve's book, A Fly Fishing Guide to Rocky Mountain National Park. So, congratulations. And what you're going to have to do there is, Jeff, is send me either in that same text box, send me your name, address, phone number, email address so that we can get this book out to you, and or, like Steve said, maybe meet up for a cup of coffee and get the book to you, either way. But send that information so that Steve can have that and be able to contact you and get the book to you. Or you could send that information to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. So thanks for playing, everybody, and thank you, Steve, for being on the show tonight. It's a great, great pleasure to talk with you and learn more about fishing in my home state here and share that with other people, and thanks for your time.
Well, Roger, thank you so much. I'm honored.
Yeah, it was great, and on our next podcast, which will be on February, when is our next broadcast? Our next broadcast is on April 6th and 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And we're going to be interviewing Rich Plotsky. And our topic for the show will be fly fishing with terrestrials in the Rockies. So we've got a Rockies theme going here. And then the one after that is going to be with Tom Rosenbauer with Fly Fishing Small Streams. So we've got a three-show segment here that's really going to benefit people in the Rockies and fishing the small streams. So, anyway, Rich Polotsky loves bugs, especially those that drop out of the sky, trees, or weeds. So listen in and learn the best way to fish terrestrials in the Rocky Mountain region. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Royal Gorge Anglers, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.